This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. As Russian forces retreat, Ukraine's military is keeping the pressure on, its counteroffensive pressing deeper into occupied territory. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
A source tells the AP former UN Ambassador Bill Richardson was in Moscow this week and met with Russian leaders. Last month, Richardson told the AP WNBA star Brittany Griner should be freed.
I think she has the right strategy of contrition, a good legal team.
Griner was sentenced last month to 9 years in prison in a drug possession case.
There's going to be a prisoner swap, though, and I think it'll be two for two. Involving Paul Whelan. We can't forget him.
Whelan is a corporate security executive from Michigan, serving a 16-year sentence on espionage-related charges. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced in July the U.S. has made a substantial proposal to Russia to work out a swap. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department says that Russia has spent about $300 million to covertly influence world politics. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports.
According to a newly released State Department cable, Russia has covertly spent more than $300 million since 2014 to try to influence politicians and other officials in more than two dozen countries. The cable, signed by Secretary of State Antony Blinken, cites a new intelligence assessment of Russia's global efforts to support policies and parties sympathetic to Moscow. The cable does not name specific Russian targets, but says the U.S. is providing classified information to select individual countries. It's the latest effort by the Biden administration to declassify intelligence about Moscow's military and political aims, dating back to ultimately correct assessments that Russia would launch a new war against Ukraine. Norman Hall, Washington.
There's more at voanews.com, and this is VOA News. U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has introduced a bill calling for a nationwide abortion ban. That bill would prohibit abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy, except in cases of rape, incest, or danger to the physical health of the mother.
I've chosen to craft legislation that I think is eminently reasonable in the eyes of the world, and I hope the American people. At 15 weeks, pretty much strong majority of Americans believe abortion should be the exception, not the rule.
The legislation introduced on Tuesday is sending shockwaves through both parties, with just weeks before voters go to the polls. Graham's own Republican colleagues did not immediately embrace his abortion ban bill, which has almost no chance of becoming law in the Democratic-held Congress. Democrats reject it as extreme and an alarming signal of where Republicans are headed if they win control of the House and Senate in November. Fighting between Armenia and Azerbaijan has continued and killed about 100 troops and fed fears of broader hostilities between the longtime adversaries. Armenia's defense ministry said the fighting erupted early Tuesday, with Azerbaijani forces unleashing an artillery barrage and drone attacks. The ministry said fighting continued during the day despite Russia's attempt to broker a quick ceasefire. Azerbaijan's foreign ministry says that the country was responding to a large-scale provocation by Armenia. It said that Armenian troops planted mines and fired on Azerbaijani military positions. Two countries have been locked in a conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh, which is a part of Azerbaijan, but has been under control of ethnic Armenian forces backed by Armenia. The international community urged some form of calm. A package has exploded on the campus of Northeastern University in Boston, and the college says that a staff member suffered minor injuries. Authorities say another suspicious package was found near a prominent art museum Tuesday evening, and the FBI was assisting with that investigation. Boston's bomb squad is at the scene at the second package near the city's prestigious Museum of Fine Arts on the outskirts of the Northeastern campus. NBC Boston reports that the package that exploded went off as it was being opened near the university's Holmes Hall, which is home to the university's creative writing program. The FBI is assisting in that investigation. There is more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Thank you. Today's Wednesday, September 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, intense fighting rages in northeastern Ukraine as Kyiv reclaims more territories from Russia forces.
Ukrainian forces have already taken under control the city of Svatopluk. It's Donetsk region, but it is very close to Izum, and this is the city was also very important in terms of its location.
The UN urges Sri Lanka's new elected government to implement democratic reforms and combat impunity.
UN Acting High Commissioner for Human Rights, Nada Al-Nashif, is expressing concern over certain actions taken by the new government in recent weeks.
And the coffin of Queen Elizabeth II returns to Buckingham Palace. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says that his forces have recaptured over 6,000 square kilometers that were previously under Russian control. However, intense fighting continues in Ukraine's northeastern Kharkiv region. From Kyiv, Anna Chernikova speaks with Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller.
Ukrainian forces have already taken under control the city of Svatopluk. It's Donetsk region, but it is very close to Izum, and this is a city was also very important in terms of its location and in terms of its historic meaning, because it has one of the biggest churches, Lavra, located in there. And Ukrainian forces have already entered this territory. In general, all the territories that have been liberated in these past days are now under very deep clearing procedure by the Ukrainian forces, and we hear that some fightings continue to happen on the border of the Donetsk region and Luhansk region, but we should not forget about Kherson region, because also heavy fightings are happening there. And as Minister of the Defense of Ukraine, Mr. Reznikov, said today that the counteroffensive actions in the Kherson region are slower than in Kharkiv region due to the specifics of the location and of the territory.
Overnight, President Zelensky mentioned that because of the offensive, Ukrainian forces have reclaimed from Russian control over 6,000 square kilometers.
This is correct. President Zelensky confirmed that over 6,000 square kilometers have been liberated in general by the Ukrainian forces. So it's generally along the whole front line. And this was also confirmed by the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense. If we talk about Kharkiv region, the Ministry of Defense today confirmed that the Ukrainian forces have liberated more than 300 settlements around 3,800 square kilometers just in the Kharkiv region.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine Steve Miller from Kyiv. Experts say Ukraine has dealt its opponent a major operational defeat with a surprise counteroffensive in the country's northeast, sending shockwaves through the invading Russian army. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain looks at the likely impact of Ukrainian military gains on the war.
Experts say they are stunned by Ukraine's surprise gains and Russia's rapid retreat. Craig Albert is a professor of political science at Augusta University.
It seems to be just a complete failure of logistics, strategy, tactics on the Russian side. Everything is just falling apart. Their lines are collapsing. Troops are leaving, running behind, and leaving all of their ammunition, leaving vehicles, leaving weapons. That's just astonishing to me that it's such a disorganized kind of retreat.
The past few days have taken a toll on Russian soldiers' morale. Retired U.S. Army Brigadier General Peter Svak, a former U.S. defense attaché to Russia, told VOA.
But you see aspects of the Russians melting down in places. And that type of thing is infectious in a negative way when the troops lose their will to fight. And that appears to be happening no matter what the orders are from above. Things get really bad, and that's what we're hearing, certainly around Kherson and up near Kharkiv.
Another expert told VOA that Ukraine's battlefield successes are occurring at a critical point in the seven-month war. Luke Coffey is a senior fellow with the Hudson Institute via Zoom.
So these advancements are huge. They come at a time when we're starting to have another debate in the West about providing more assistance and more military aid.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky praised the bravery of Ukrainian troops and condemned Russia for striking back at civilian infrastructure and causing widespread blackouts in the Kharkiv and Donetsk regions.
And I think that Russia's targeting of these of the civilian infrastructure, of the electrical power plants and water plants, is a sign of desperation. When you know you're losing on the battlefield, this is what you do. No reasonable military commander would suggest that we should use $30 million worth of ballistic missiles to take Ukraine's electric grid off for a couple of hours. But this is exactly what we're seeing.
There has not been much official Russian reaction yet to the Ukrainian advances, but on Sunday, a military map presented by the Russian Defense Ministry showed that its forces have made a major withdrawal from the Kharkiv region. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Thank you, Cindy. A report of the human rights situation in Sri Lanka urges the newly elected government to implement democratic reforms and combat impunity to prevent reoccurrence of human rights violations. The report was submitted Monday to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Widespread protests over shockingly high levels of inflation, shortages of fuel, food, medicines, and other essential items led to the resignation of the previous Sri Lankan president on July 14th. A week later, a new president was elected by parliament. The handover of power was largely peaceful. However, UN Acting High Commissioner for Human Rights, Nada Al-Nashif, is expressing concern over certain actions taken by the new government in recent weeks.
Scores of leaders and members of the protest movement and trade unions have been arrested. Particularly troubling was the use of the Prevention of Terrorism Act to arrest three student leaders on 18 August. I urge the government not to revert to this reliance on draconian security laws, but to take positive action to foster an environment for peaceful protests, critical discussion and debate.
She says the government has a fresh opportunity to steer the country on the path toward justice and reconciliation and to address the legacy of conflict. Sri Lanka's 26-year-long civil war ended 13 years ago. However, Al-Nashif notes tens of thousands of survivors still do not know the fate of their missing loved ones, nor have they received justice and reparations. She says there must be accountability for past human rights violations and abuses. She asserts the government should seize the opportunity offered by the changed circumstances in the country to right these wrongs.
Impunity remains a central obstacle to the rule of law, reconciliation, and Sri Lanka's sustainable peace and development. This impunity continues to embolden those committing human rights violations and has created fertile ground for corruption and the abuse of power, as well as contributing to the present economic crisis.
In response, Sri Lanka's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Ali Sabri, said the government was aware of the socioeconomic hardships faced by its people and was taking measures to improve their situation. He said steps also have been taken to strengthen democratic governance and to combat corruption. He added the immediate concern was economic recovery, but advancing the human rights of Sri Lankan people was of equal importance. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A hospital official in Ethiopia's Tigray region says an airstrike Tuesday in the capital Mekelle hit a university campus and a TV station, wounding at least one person. Henry Wilkins reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
A hospital official in the Tigrayan capital of Mekelle says an airstrike hit the city Tuesday morning. Kibrom Gebreselassie, the CEO of Ada Referral Hospital, told the Reuters news agency that the regional government-run Dimitsi Wayane TV station and the business campus of Mekelle University were hit by the strike. On Twitter, Tigrayan government spokesperson Getachew Reda said Ethiopian government drones hit the business campus of the school. An Ethiopian government spokesperson did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The strike comes 2 days after Tigrayan officials appeared to offer an olive branch to the Ethiopian federal government, saying they will agree to peace negotiations mediated by the African Union. Tigray had previously demanded the Kenyan government mediate the talks. The federal government has stated it is ready to start talks with no requirements, although a humanitarian blockade and a banking and telecoms blackout remain in place on Tigray. On Sunday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on the parties to seize this opportunity for peace and to take steps to end the violence definitively and opt for dialogue. Fighting in Ethiopia's nearly two-year civil war resumed after a five-month ceasefire on August 24th. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
In a two-day meeting in Berlin, the United States, United Kingdom, Italy, France, Turkey, Egypt, and the host Germany have reiterated their commitment to supporting a comprehensive path to elections in Libya as the only solution to the country's crisis. Wolfgang Putzai is a former Austrian military attaché in Libya. VOA senior analyst Mohamed Elshinawi asked him whether their support could convince the rival governments in Libya to agree on a constitutional basis for holding the long-awaited elections.
The influence of the international community on the Libyan actors is quite limited, even the influence of Turkey and of the United States. Nevertheless, the meeting of several of the most important countries with regard to Libya makes absolutely sense right now. After the failure of Stephanie Williams' last constitutional initiative to force or, let's say, urge the House of Representatives and the High Council of State to a consensus about the constitutional foundation for the elections, after the de facto decision in the struggle for the prime minister between Dabeiba and Bashagha, where Dabeiba succeeded, after the appointment of the new UN Special Representative and head of ANSMIL, Abdoulaye Badili, and after the louder voices inside Libya demanding decentralization based on the original 10 governorates, like, for example, by the Presidential Council deputy Musa Al-Khoni, or the demands for the reinstatement of the former federalist constitution, they have quite a lot of topics to talk. So it makes certainly sense that they discuss their standpoints and potential way forward right now.
The Emir of Qatar, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, met Sunday with Speaker of the Libyan House of Representatives, Aqila Saleh, and they discussed the latest developments in Libya. The talks came 3 days after another meeting between the Qatari ruler and Abdelhamid Dbeiba, the Prime Minister of the Government of National Unity, where they discussed supporting international efforts to hold elections. What do you make of that?
Qatar has been an important actor in Libya since after the revolution, backing several Islamist groups, including the Muslim Brotherhood. This made Qatar naturally to a staunch support of the governments in Tripoli. On the other side, this led to quite strained relationships with Qatar and the House of Representatives, ailing in the east, as well as with most of the eastern part of Libya. After the rapprochement between Qatar and the other Gulf Cooperation Council states, economic interests, especially with regard to the hydrocarbon sector, become a driving element in Qatar's policy towards Libya. With the arrival of Libya Political Dialogue Forum's selected Prime Minister Dabeiba, with his special personal relationship to the Arab Emirates, the relationship between Qatar and Libya's government somehow cooled down. Consequently, Qatar favored a rival Prime Minister Fatih Bashagha in the struggle for the Prime Minister. After Dabeiba prevailed right now, it was time for Doha to get closer to Dabeiba in order to facilitate its economic interests in Libya.
That's former Austrian military attaché in Libya, Wolfgang Putzai, speaking with my colleague Mohamed Elshinawi. In other news, the coffin of Queen Elizabeth II returned to Buckingham Palace on Tuesday evening, making its way through a drizzly London as crowds lined on the route for a glimpse of the hearse and to bid her a final farewell. People parked their cars along a normally busy road, got out and waved at the hearse with lights inside illuminating the flag-draped coffin, made its way into London. In the city, people pressed in on the road and held their phones aloft as it passed. Thousands outside the palace cheered, shouted, quote, "God save the Queen," unquote, and clapped as the hearse swung around the roundabout in front of the Queen's official London residence and through the wrought iron gates. Her son, King Charles III, and other immediate family members waited inside. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. More than 50 African ministers are gathering in Senegal this week for the African Ministerial Conference on the Environment. Plastics and harmful burning of waste are high on the agenda, as Anika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar, Senegal.
Titled Africa's Participation in Developing an International...
The conference is taking place in the wake of major flooding and drought throughout the continent, which have aggravated food insecurity, damaged vital infrastructure, and cost fragile economies billions of dollars. On top of these disasters is the issue of plastic pollution and the burning of waste, which releases methane and other harmful gases into the environment. Richard Muning is the Deputy Regional Director of the United Nations Environment Programme's Africa Office.
If that is not addressed, it will not only end up creating inconvenience in cities, but at the same time, the open burning is causing outdoor pollution. And so converting that waste into opportunities, like recycling plastic waste into plastic tiles where young people can actually be able to learn skills, will create jobs.
About 600 million Africans die from air pollution-related illnesses each year, according to the UN Environment Programme. The ministers in attendance will also discuss the development of an international agreement on plastic pollution, a major issue in African countries where waste management systems and anti-littering education are often lacking. Griffin Zocheng is the executive director of the Center for Environmental Justice and Development.
We have to ensure that Africa call out the major causes, the producers who cause the problem of plastic, to take their action in curbing plastic production, removing harmful substances in the production, and looking at the redesign of the product.
John Kerry, the U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, is expected to attend the conference Wednesday and Thursday to discuss methane emissions, climate adaptation, and waste management. Bagdi Dada is the Executive Director of Gambia's National Environment Agency. Dada says he hopes the event will allow attendees to create meaningful partnerships that span the globe.
It is important for us to work as a team, look at areas of concern, and maximize how best we can work on those issues. Environment has no boundaries. What affects us here also goes to other parts of the world.
The conference will continue through Friday. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
Forget the Silk Road, the new frontier in China's quest for influence in Africa involves going beyond the planet Earth as the Asian giant looks to the continent as a key partner in its space ambitions. Kit Butler reports from Johannesburg.
What do astronauts eat in space? That's what one Ethiopian student wanted to know last week when he and young Africans from eight countries took part in a dialogue with Chinese astronauts in orbit. The event via video link was organized by China's mission to the African Union. Here's the answer to the food question by one of the Chinese astronauts, Sai Shu Jia, broadcast by Chinese state media CGTN.
Our ground team has prepared more than 1,000 varieties of food. Look, we have delicious purple rice porridge, tasty sauteed sweet corn, sauteed diced beef in black pepper sauce. We also have rice.
The event was a show of soft power on Beijing's part, but also indicates the importance the country is placing on the role Africa can help it play in the global space race, experts said. Timideo Oniosan, a Nigerian space scientist and managing director of the website Space in Africa, told VOA the African space economy in 2021 was valued at $19.49 billion and is forecast to grow by some 16% in the next 4 years.
The space industry in Africa is growing at an incredible rate. Hence, countries in regions like China, Europe, Russia, and the US are beginning to compete for a stake in the industry.
However, as of this year, only 13 African countries have 48 satellites. Six of them built by China. China launched Nigeria's first communications satellite in 2007 and its second 4 years later. It also launched Algeria's first communications satellite in 2017, as well as the first satellites for Ethiopia and Sudan in 2019. In 2018, experts said Tunisia was the site of the first ground-receiving station outside of China for its Beidou satellite navigation system. Space may be more abstract than China's Belt and Road Initiative infrastructure projects throughout Africa, but those projects may be one motivation for China's interest in African nations' space programs, analysts say. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA has updated its request for another attempt to launch the Artemis 1 test flight to the moon and back on September 27th. A possible backup launch date of October 2nd is also being reviewed. The space agency says the new dates will allow time to prepare for the launch, adjust logistics, conduct any needed tests, and refresh the rocket's fuel supply. NASA's previous attempt to launch its powerful new SLS rocket with its Orion capsule atop was on September 3rd. But the liftoff had to be scrubbed due to a hydrogen leak that was found as propellant was being loaded. The space agency says that Artemis 1 teams completed repair work to the area of a hydrogen leak. If the rocket launches on September 27th, it will return to Earth on November 5th, or November 11th if the launch takes place October 2nd. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Every year, world leaders gather in New York for the annual United Nations General Assembly. Count on VOA to be there, delivering news you can trust on radio, TV, and the web. A free press is essential. VOA Africa, your trusted source for news and information.
This has been International Edition under Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issue City News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned by the decision by the Hanoi People's High Court to uphold the 9-year prison sentence of renowned Vietnamese author and journalist Pham Doi Trang. As State Department spokesperson Ned Price noted in a statement expressing concerns over the decision, Trang is recognized internationally for her work to advance human rights and good governance in Vietnam and was a 2022 winner of the Secretary of State's International Women of Courage Award. Trang was arrested in October 2020 and sentenced in December 2021 to 9 years in prison under Article 117 of Vietnam's Criminal Code, which criminalizes making, storing, distributing, or disseminating information, documents, and items against the Socialist Republic of Vietnam. International human rights organizations have called Article 117 a tool to silence individuals who are critical of the government, whether they are journalists, writers, or citizens exercising their fundamental right to free expression. The UN Working Group of Arbitrary Detention found Trang's detention to be arbitrary and in contravention of Vietnam's international human rights commitments and obligations. The government held Trang in pretrial custody for a year without allowing her access to a lawyer. In the nearly 2 years she has been detained, Trang's health has reportedly suffered. Spokesperson Price said the United States urges Vietnam to ensure adequate medical care and to allow access to Trang to assess her medical condition. In its most recent report on human rights conditions in Vietnam, the State Department cited NGOs that estimated as of August 2021, authorities held between 130 and 288 persons for political reasons. The State Department wrote, from January 1st to November 9th, authorities detained 29 and convicted 27 persons who were exercising internationally recognized human rights, such as freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, and association. Spokesperson Price said, Trang's continued detention is the latest instance in an alarming pattern of arrests and sentencing of individuals in Vietnam for peacefully expressing their opinions. We call on the Vietnamese government to release Trang and to allow all individuals in Vietnam to exercise their right to freedom of expression without fear of retaliation, consistent with the human rights provisions in Vietnam's constitution and Vietnam's international obligations and commitments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.